And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Nice and warm out there. It has gotten a little gray as we have some clouds, and there's even some shower activity north of Butler moving out of our listening area now. But, boy, folks up in Harrisville, Eau Claire, Parker, got a little bit of a shower activity. Doesn't look like there's anything more to come, and we'll see. We'll keep an eye on the radar for you. That's been in and out of the weather forecast all morning. First they had it in there, and then they took it out, and it was back in again. We'll just kind of go with the flow. Let Mother Nature do what she wants. Temperatures are, in fact, going to get to 80 today, and they're still talking about near 90 tomorrow, so just enjoy. We have a good program today. We're going to have an Ask the Veterinarian Day in just a second here. I do want to tell you that later on the program we're going to be talking about foster parenting. And also about an interesting concept. Jonathan Ferreira will be with us. He is a gallery owner, and he's got an exhibition mounted called Guns in the Hands of Artists. Now, this is not an anti-gun exhibit or book, but it's an anti-gun violence book. So it sounds like he might be interesting to talk to. We'll chat with him a little bit later. It's down south somewhere. We have a museum. First, though, we say hello and welcome back to a friend of long standing, and that's local veterinarian Dr. Dennis Damon, who's been off taking care of some health problems. And my goodness, Dr. Damon, is it ever good to see you sitting across the table from me again, for goodness sake. Welcome back.
I'm glad to be here in person, and it's such an overwhelming Butler community that gave me the ability to be here. So a lot of faithful people out there.
Well, I'm sure that our listeners are going to want me to ask, how you doing? How you feeling? Are you feeling better?
Yeah, we're making progress. The stem cell transplant was very successful. Put my disease, which you can't really call it a cancer disease. It's more of a disease, the amyloidosis. And it put the mother cell to sleep to a point where it is in remission. But it's kind of left me in a little bit of a time where shortness of breath and things like that. Mm-hmm. But we're capable of coming back and doing some work at the clinic, and with the help of a couple other veterinarians that are there. Keep things going, and the community coming in. So hopefully everything will go well.
Good. So you're getting your strength back, huh?
Yep.
A little bit at a time.
Huh? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, good to have you with us again, that's for sure. I wanted to talk about, in fact, we had a couple of questions about this over the last week on the program. I knew you were coming in today. I've seen a couple of articles in magazines. In fact, most recently in Time, it was just the most recent edition, I guess it was last week's edition of Time magazine. It was called, it was in their science section called Secrets of the Canine Mind. And just to give you kind of an overview of the article, they start out saying that any pet owner, any dog owner would realize that dogs are pretty intelligent, you know, and you can almost communicate with them to a certain degree, and they can almost communicate with you with their eyes, you know, with the way they wag their tail or whatever. But there's been some interesting research going on at several veterinary schools and research labs across the country, very prestigious ones, and they're doing things like, they have one dog in particular. It's a three-year-old pit bull down at Emory University in Atlanta, very prestigious medical school at Emory there. And it's one of the few dogs in the world who has been trained to sit utterly still in an MRI so that they can take images, repeated images of her brain while she's doing things. And then medical researchers can kind of figure out how the brain's working. And they're finding out astonishing things about dogs. Stuff that pet owners kind of knew intuitively, but now they've got science to start to back it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, we don't expect dogs to start talking. We're not, we're not being silly here. But obviously they are very intelligent, and they can communicate in their own way.
Mm-hmm. It's very, very interesting that dogs, which any dog owner can tell you, that they'll say, well, he kind of knows what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, he's reading you through various conditioning that he does to you, which you don't even really know. He watches you every day and doing something and things, and that's why dogs can open doors, because those dogs have a brain consistent enough, they're smart enough, they watch their owners open the door consistent enough that they then go over and try turning the knob, and then they master that, and they watch again various things you do, and they can actually fool you a lot of times. I had this one dog where the owner swore up and down that it was her husband getting into the refrigerator downstairs and eating part of the leftovers from the day before. But the dog was smart enough to go downstairs, open the refrigerator, and eat a section out of the tray and put it back and shut the door and come upstairs. And they never knew this, but then I told them that they should start putting a camera on the refrigerator door, because they're probably, it's the dog, but I said, mm-hmm. I doubt whether it's the your husband. But lo and behold, the dog would sneak downstairs and had the ability to open the refrigerator door, and he got in, and I don't know what he learned him to put everything back neatly and things, but everything went back neatly, so it looked like somebody else did it.
Now, this would require a certain type of refrigerator door. Some dogs wouldn't be able to get into. Same as doors, the new handles on doors, we have them in our building here. There, it's more of a lever than just
right,
a knob.
Right, so it requires a little bit of thought, but there are some handles they can't handle,
mm-hmm.
And things, but it kind of woke me up a little bit in saying that if they're that intelligent, then they're watching us consistently, and that's how they can figure out where we're going to go, when we're going to come home, what we're going to do next. And a lot of people say he knows exactly when I get home because he's there at the door ready to greet me.
Yeah.
And they don't go by time or watches or anything like that. So dogs and animals have incredible minds.
Now, there are certain dogs that are more intelligent than others, right?
Right.
Now, I'm going
right.
to guess some of the breeds that are commonly used for service dogs, Lab, in some cases, German Shepherds, they're pretty intelligent
dogs.
Yeah,
their dogs can be trained for sniffing and finding things, doing things. There's like the bloodhound that have mm-hmm. noses that they use to get scents, and they can sense smells ahead of you way that we can't even see and taste and things. They know a scent, and that's the reason why they can, if a person was there 2 days ago, there's certain things that are left as imprints that those dogs can imprint on to find where they've been and where they're at, and the dog does certain things during that particular ability. So there's various breeds for various things that we incorporate into use and testing and things. There's animals that they used, like the beagle, is a very common animal for testing because they mimic our digestive systems and things close. So does a pig. The pig actually mimics our digestive system closely. And lo and behold, one of the little guys that we don't think about much, but the guinea pig is a little rodent that they use because of the fact that it has the ability to do and have the systems similar to what humans do in relevance to some of these trials and things, and they can use prototype models as opposed to the guinea pig itself. Once they get the data put in, then it's the computer can do the work of what the guinea pig used to tell us.
Dr. Dennis Damon is with us. His practice is at Suburban Animal Clinic. It's on Route 8 south of Butler, about 5 miles south of Butler, right at the intersection with the Thorncrest Drive. Phone number is 283-2525. Questions, comments, we would welcome them. 283-2525. 283-2525. I was walking down the street this past weekend. I forget what day it was. It was downtown Butler, and a gentleman was coming toward me with two dogs. They were smaller dogs. I don't know exactly what breed they were. Both on leashes. And they were coming toward me, and I thought, no, I want to make sure I do the right thing. You know, I don't want to get in the way. I don't want to disturb anything like that. Dogs were perfectly behaved, walked right past me as if I wasn't there. You know, I thought they were going to come sniffing around or whatever, you know. Very well-trained animals.
Yeah, if you would have stopped, they would have probably saw you and maybe possibly not. But if the owner said, let's go, keep going, they would have probably passed you by too. But if you would have stopped, they would have probably looked at you at least, and one of them would have maybe tried. But owners can have their dogs well trained to a point where they walk very well, and that's the way it should be. They shouldn't be out of hand. They should be in tune with their master, and when he says something, they're doing that consistently, as opposed to on their own wandering and doing what they want to do. It's what their master wants to do, and they were probably in sync with him.
By the way, when you're approaching a dog, this is different from what I was talking about, but any dog, if it's a relative, neighbor, whatever, the correct way to pet a dog, I was reading about this, it's not to pat the dog on the head, right?
Right.
That is not the thing to do, which is common reaction for people.
And a lot of people will take their hand and push out to them.
Yeah.
But what you should do is stand still and let the dog come to you. That way you're not getting into the space of their owner, which they're defending that space. So if you walk and the dog is alert and you're talking to the owner and says, may I pet your dog, and you stretch your hand out and you're trying to pet, he could bite you even with the owner's giving you permission. What you don't have is the permission of the dog to pet him. And that's when what you want to do is there's a space between you, dog, and owner. And you stop and you let the dog come to you. If he doesn't, then I would not be petting that dog, because if you try to force pet, he may bite you. So it's up to the dog to initiate his friendliness, as opposed to we trying to initiate the friendliness and petting him and things. So.
And that's very common. I've seen people do that 100 times, where they will reach out and start, you know, to especially on the head. But it's absolutely the wrong thing to do. Hold your hand out. Let the dog come to you.
Right.
If they want to.
Right. Yeah. Because if you're going to get bit, you're going to get bit that way. Now, there are some dogs that allow you to do anything, because they're a very submissive dog, and they'll let you pet them and do anything you want. But there are some that there's that protective area that they're now you're entering, which you weren't allowed to by the dog. The owner gave you permission, but the dog did not, and he's on guard. And so if you reach out your hand, there's a good possibility that 50% of the time you'll get bit.
By far the most popular pet, right? I saw, in fact, it was in this Time magazine article. I forget how many millions of dogs there are in the United States. It's an estimate, but pretty accurate. But nearly half of all the people in the United States have a dog. Which that surprised me. I didn't realize it was that high a percentage.
Yeah, I would venture to say, yeah.
It was close to half. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know, it's 48% or something like that. People have dogs. Yeah. And it's a pet that's been utilized as a pet for centuries, thousands of years, as a mm-hmm. matter of fact, not just centuries. 283-2525 is the number. It is Ask the Veterinarian Day today, 283-2525. It's warm weather season. People are outdoors a lot more. We should mention the concern about rabies because especially when kids, well, even adults are outdoors. We have to worry about, first of all, raccoons, right? Mm-hmm. They can carry rabies.
Skunks.
Skunks, okay.
Foxes.
Oh, yeah, foxes. I forgot
squirrels,
about
that. Groundhogs are some of the ones that we are in the upper echelon.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know groundhogs till a couple of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I guess. I was playing golf one day. In our foursome, we were walking down the fairway, and there was a groundhog, rather a small one, acting kind of crazy. It was, you know, kind of going around in circles in the fairway. And we got up to it, and, you know, there was some foam, saliva foam, and so on. That animal has rabies, I think.
Could, or some sort of disease is causing him to be ill and frothing and things.
We steered clear.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
I mean, it was a very big animal, but something you don't want to mess around with, right?
No. It. What thing would have been is to report it to the groundskeeper, and he would have gotten it so that if taken necessary precautions and things, but gotten it off the course so that nobody...
Well, it ran off into the woods.
Yeah,
so.
And so maybe not. But definitely rabies is a very, very high threat. Actually, any time of the year, but more so now, these animals are out and they're having their young, and we as humans see these, and we try to, and when we see young, but no mothers and things, mothers are around watching, but we try to go in and interrupt that cycle and get mm-hmm. a hold of them and things, and that's what's wrong. Our curiosity sometimes puts the wildlife at a risk factor.
And this curiosity can be a danger for our pets, our dogs and cats, right? Because mm-hmm. they tend to be curious. How many times have you seen them, you know,
right.
get aroused by another animal and go off? It doesn't take much contact, does it, with a rabid animal for a dog to contract rabies?
No. And the unfortunate thing is if your dog's not vaccinated, then technically if the animal is declared rabid, so we'll just say we had a skunk and your dog bit that skunk or got in a fight with it, but then it died.
Mm-hmm.
And then necessary precautions were taken that the head was removed and it was sent into the state lab and it came back positive, and your dog's not vaccinated for rabies, then comes a quarantine of that your dog, strict quarantine too. This is not just a quarantine that you can take your dog on leash and go places with him. He has to stay at the house in confinement,
mm-hmm.
and one person has to be feeding the animal during this quarantine period. And if there's any changes in your animal, then there's a good possibility that he may be put to sleep. But if not...
Let's take a call. 283-2525 is our number. If you have questions or comments for us today, 283-2525. Hi there. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn with veterinarian Dr. Dennis Damon.
Hi, Dave, and hi, Doctor.
Hi.
I owned two puggles. I have one that's 9 years old and one that's 7 year old 7-month-old puppy.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to touch some bases with you on a couple of things. I had the puppy in puppy classes,
mm-hmm.
and all the dogs did fantastic, but mine was scared of everything. I had trouble getting him in the door, and eventually he would come in on his own. And on the last class, they have all the dogs walk around the chair in the middle of the floor, and he did that
mm-hmm.
before he would just sit there.
Mm-hmm.
So I, he's coming around. He's not so much scared of things, but like really loud noises, he just is really as scared of. Could there be a reason for that? Is it something?
Possibly no, but
uh-huh.
When did you get the dog or the puppy? What age?
I think he was 8 weeks old.
Yeah. And see, there's a period of time. Now, that's when everybody gives the dogs up, about 8 weeks of age. And it's about right. But see, in the learning sequence, the mother teaches them something between 6 weeks of age and 16 weeks of age.
Hmm.
And mm-hmm. you took the dog at 8 weeks of age, and mm-hmm. he was being taught and things, but then the interruption came, and now he's under the control of another person who now isn't exposing him to the things that the mother rightly teaches them during a period that they learn things. And this mm-hmm. is sort of like a school to them between 6 weeks and 16 weeks of what they get and how the mother teaches them things. And one mm-hmm. of the things is, as we intermix breeds and things, we're losing some of the concept of the ability of dogs to teach these things to their siblings. Simply because it becomes a money aspect of producing pets and getting $200-$400 or whatever the selling price is, and not caring about what is to happen to that puppy and how these learning abilities happen. So theoretically, we all blame because a broom dropped on the floor and the dog reacted to it. We think that some human being got a broom and that either used it on a dog or something like that. And it all kind of stems back to the training that would have mm-hmm. occurred when they were in their stages of development of mm-hmm. 1 to 4 weeks of age. They're underneath the influence of Mother Nature because their eyes aren't open, their ears aren't open, their senses are starting to develop. But that's the only thing they're using till about 10 to 14 days is their sense of smell. Once their eyes open and once their ears open, now they've got three senses going for them and things. And then the mother takes them and teaches them some of the things that they're going to be exposed to. But again, as we intermix breeds and we get Puggles and then we get somebody else that introduces another dog in and they call it another Puggy Poo Puggle, you're messing with things. I think part of the development of these animals is the development phase that they go through a motherhood and what she teaches, but she's not there.
That's
so you get her.
Yeah.
And right. What did you do between the time you got her for the next, 10 weeks? Did you do anything with her? You probably didn't, other than you made picked her up and made smoochy moochies to her face and cuddles and things like that. But her mother doesn't do that.
Right.
Her mother scolds her, and if she does something wrong, she learns that was wrong. So mm-hmm. some of our development problems in pets are brought about by human beings, and some of the developmental problems of how animals respond to you, sounds and things are all sort of trained in that period of time. So I'm not banking to tell the breeder should keep the dogs 16 to 20 weeks of age. That's somewhat impossible for them. But you got to take into consideration that their learning abilities and things are taught in the first 20 weeks of age.
She could still grow out of this, though, right?
Oh yeah,
the puppy. I mean,
she keeps working with the dog and sounds and get her used to it and exposing to her slowly. But she probably can't do it totally on her own. She needs somebody that has some behavior experience guiding her, such as either doing books or even on TV. They have some of these animal behavioralists on TV that if you watch them and things, you get ideas as to how to help your pet get through some of the problems.
Did you say you had another question about your other dog, caller?
Yes, I do. I just wanted to just make a comment, though. He is coming along very well, probably up to like 75% compared to when I first got him.
And that's your
patient with him,
right?
Yeah,
that's
and,
a good sign.
Patience and exposing very slowly to some of these sounds,
right.
And
exactly.
Use treats to help him through it, and. They don't learn on the first one or two or three times. It takes repetition.
Yeah. And the older dog surprisingly helps a lot.
He's a guidance for him. Definitely, yeah, he'll teach him things that were supposed to be taught by the mother. He will help teach this pet to be a little bit more in line and things, but he also, if he has any bad traits, you don't want his bad traits taught to your little puppy, so you got to kind of watch what he's teaching.
Yeah, well, the older dog's he's a good dog.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the other question I want to ask you is like about ticks and Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm.
I have my dogs, I take them to the vet, and I have them on Ectavil, I don't know if I'm saying it right, for ticks, please. Okay. And I have a friend, and she has four dogs.
Mm-hmm.
They're all poodles. And she does not get the shots, and she doesn't do this.
Mm-hmm.
So now she has one little poodle that has Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she just says, you know, she has heard that it doesn't matter whether they get the shots and the pills, they can still get the Lyme disease. Now, is this so? And if it is so, is there any, does these companies back you up if your pet gets them? Because I give them to mine faithfully.
Well, if you give the shots and you do something to protect them both internally and externally, vaccinations aren't 100 foolproof that they're going to protect your dog because there's nothing 100%. But your dog has an immunity within itself that if he is exposed, he will have the ability to knock off the virus much better than somebody who says, that's just all bogus and I'm not going to do that. And he gets bit by a tick and he gets Lyme disease. Now, I've vaccinated my dogs ever since the vaccine has come out. And also I've used various products on them because what I have at my practice, I have to use on my own pets as guinea pigs so that if it doesn't work, I'm not going to carry it at the practice. But I've had them on a topical, and I do one thing at the end of the year that I don't sort of advocate for my clients to do, but it's just for my principle, knowing that the animals are continually staying negative. But I do a Lyme's test at the end of the year on them just to check out if vaccinations and the medicine that we're using is keeping them negative. And
yeah, they get those tests too, yes.
Yeah, and they've stayed negative for the last 10 years. Now, I've had people that have started the vaccine, but they don't keep up with it. Intermittently, right. They keep up with it. Well, when you do that, you lessen the fact that it's going to work. You've got to be mm-hmm. jolly on the spot within 30 days each year of giving that Lyme shot.
Don't we need it once a year?
Mm-hmm.
But you have to get it at the same time every year, about
the same time. But when they initially get it, they should be checked and make sure they're negative. And then they get two shots then, one initially mm-hmm. and a booster, then yearly after that. And like I said, all my dogs that I've vaccinated, I have never seen Lyme's disease ever occur in them. And the owners that have kept up with both the topical and the injections, I have not mm-hmm. seen Lyme's in. But the people who intermittently come in or occasionally get it, but then they're not faithful, I've seen Lyme's develop in their pet. Then they wonder why, if the shot's supposed to do all this work, but then you go on their record and they miss 2 years in a row, but then we resumed it. But we don't know what happened in that 2 years, and sometimes we'll be able to check if they allow us to do the blood work. If it's negative, then we can resume the shot. But they got to be faithful, and they got to both approach it from the standpoint that you're doing this 365 days of the year. You just don't mm-hmm. put a collar on them or treat them for a 90-day or we'll just say a half a year and forget the other half of the year because mm-hmm. that's cold.
What's a topical? How do you put – is that like a cream or something?
There's a medicine that can both treat fleas and ticks that you can put on them.
Is it in a collar?
It's in a little tube. Uh-huh. And the tube goes on the dog, and it's absorbed into the skin and then gives them protection and against fleas and ticks. And then there's mm-hmm. a collar that you can use that's good for 8 months. It's very effective. I've tried using that with some of the people that hunt coons and all hunting dogs, and the hunters actually come back and always buy them because they say, I can't believe this, because before when he'd go in, we would pick numerous ticks off of him. Now he goes in and we don't see any ticks. So I just yesterday saw a dog that the lady bought over the counter Seresta collars. She moved here from North Carolina. And she said she used the collars faithfully. I hadn't know that because I just have to take her word mm-hmm. on it. But her dog came in vomiting, listless, sluggish, diarrhea, and things. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking more towards pancreatic problem, things like that. So we started testing for this dog and things. And we got her CBC back, and I noticed there was a little bit of anemia, and her platelets were down. And then when the chemistries came back, she was in full-blown kidney disease. So I said to her, did your dog ever get Lyme's vaccines? And she said, no, I don't really believe in them, but I've been using these collars for the last 2-3 years. And I said, well, how religious are you on them? And she said, well, I put them on, and then when I feel like it, changing them, I'll change them. Well,
not so good.
I don't know whether that's – but anyway, we checked her for Lyme's disease. And the blood went in the test, and before the blood was gone, the test had turned positive, which kind of meant that this dog really had Lyme's disease pretty quick. And he was in Lyme's nephritis. And the unfortunate things, dogs can have Lyme's disease, and we can treat Lyme's disease, but when it attacks the kidneys, we have no chance of saving that dog. So I ended up having to put her best friend to sleep simply because of a theory that she had. and things. And she's got five other dogs at home. And I said, I could treat your dog and try to see if we can save it. But I said, your money is better spent on your five dogs at home and deciding on whether they have Lyme's disease and treating for it as opposed to treating this dog. Because I said, you can go to two or three veterinarians and they'll all tell the same. We can't help your dog once it enters and starts treating the kidneys.
You better, caller, you better tell this story to your friend who's
so
I will.
When you're dealing with this, my opinion is do what is out there as opposed to your feelings, because your feelings sometimes can get you into trouble.
Thanks for the call.
Mm-hmm.
Good to talk with
okay.
you today.
Can I just ask you one more thing? You don't have to talk to me. I'll just hang up.
Okay.
I just wanted you to explain to the people what their pet has to go through once they have Lyme disease, the treatment is.
Okay. Well, good question. Thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Our phone number is 283-2525. Some of the symptoms can vary, right?
Right. I mean, there's anything from lameness, which is the common thing that we see a lot of.
Start limping.
To just the dog doesn't feel right, is gimpy, maybe a little bit of vomiting, and just kind of is not itself. And that's sort of it to the extent of anything that occurs. Can you have your suspicions? But what you do is you draw a, or at least what I do is draw up a CBC and look to see if there's any anemia warranted or the platelets are low. And if they're being disturbed and things, then I will go and do the Lyme's test and see. And generally, if there's shows in the CBC that there's anemia and the platelets are low, most likely the Lyme's test is going to be positive. Not always. But positive, and to treat it, use a certain antibiotic. There's a doxycycline that's commonly used, and the other one is ampicillin can also work, but you have to go on it for 30 days, and then you should run a titer test. Now, the difference between the Lyme's test and the titer test is Lyme's tells us your dog's been exposed. The titer test tells us how far into the disease he is. So, and generally speaking, the normal is 0 to 30. That tells me that the dog is positive. But if it's 30 or below, you generally don't have to treat it. Mm-hmm. If it's 30 or above, you should treat it. If your dog comes in and it is positive for Lyme's, I generally suggest that you run the treatment, because why wait until Lyme's happens in your dog? Why are you waiting for a disease to happen? Yeah. Let's treat it before it happens so that we get it under control, so it should be treated. So for 30 days.
Let's take a break. Our phone number is 283-2525. Questions, comments, ask the veterinarian today with us here in the studio. Veterinarian Dr. Dennis Damon, his practice is at Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, 5 miles south of Butler. We'll be back to continue our conversation here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Gardening season is here, and that means it's time to take a drive through the country to Schnorr's Greenhouse. At Schnorr's Greenhouse, you'll find beautiful perennials and annuals to beautify your home for all blooming seasons. Schnorr's Greenhouse is a family-owned business, and they take great pride in providing you with the best flowers, plants, and vegetables. Schnorr's Greenhouse, located right off Herman Road, open daily 9 to 8, Saturday to 5, and Sunday 11 to 5. For 125 years, it's been where to grow. Schnorr's Greenhouse.
Concordia Visiting Nurses is a Medicare certified home health agency offering services provided by healthcare professionals like registered and licensed practical nurses, physical, speech, and occupational therapists, home health aides, and many more. We also provide specialty services like palliative care and telehealth monitoring. If you're in need of home health care, choose Concordia Visiting Nurses. Call toll free at 1-877-352-6200.
back. Nice to have you with us, folks, on this Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Dave Malarkey is my name. Our guest with us here in the studio is Dr. Dennis Damon, veterinarian at Suburban Animal Clinic. I'm just telling the doctor I've seen several stories on the newswire and the newspaper over the past, actually past couple of months now, since we realized it was going to be a very mild winter, that the ticks are expected to be worse than ever this year here in western Pennsylvania. I guess because of the mild winter.
Mild winter, the fact that we didn't get the freeze that we were supposed to get. It kind of freezes the ground below the first 2 to 3 inches, mm-hmm. and stay frozen for a period of 14 to 28 days. That generally helps to reduce the amount of insects that come out the next year fluently. And what's interesting is tick, one female tick, can give rise to 50,000 nymphs.
Oh, wow.
And although that 50,000, only maybe less than 100 ever make it. That's why they breed in such high numbers, so that they can at least have some of their progeny make it, because mm-hmm. they got to sit on a piece of grass or a blade of grass and wait for a mammal
to come by.
That would be a human being or an animal. And if you realize, if they're in a patch that rarely ever gets a deer or raccoon or maybe the occasional horse rider that comes through and get it and somehow get on the horse and get a blood sample from it so that it can move on to its next stage.
Not
and there's
live.
Actually three stages. There's nymph, larva, and then the adult. So mm-hmm. it has to go through two molts before it gets back to the tick stage. And if she raises 50,000 young, you think that's a phenomenal number, but only about 100 are going to make it. But there's enough of those ticks out there that 100 really is a incredible number.
It's 100 too many. Do you think there'll ever be a natural predator or something to start reducing this tick population? No, we had this, didn't we?
We do have a natural predator, which are chickens and guineas. Have you ever seen somebody that has chickens in their yard or mm-hmm. Guineas in their yard? They're very smart people because they know
they eat ticks.
They eat ticks. And they probably you will have in and around that home a less tick population than the next door neighbor who doesn't have anything over there. The birds and things do help, but like I said, they can't keep up with the numbers.
Well, we had the remember about 15 years ago, 20 years ago, we had the gypsy moth mm-hmm. Scourge. Now, there's still parts of Pennsylvania that have that, in central Pennsylvania, north central Pennsylvania. But around here, you know, it's practically nothing anymore.
Right.
I mean, there were people wrapping their
trees
with heavy tape, you
yeah.
know, 15, 20 years. There were people that neighbors would go together and hire a helicopter to come in and spray, you know, mm-hmm. their trees. It was horrible. And then we had, I think it was some kind of a wasp. It was a natural predator for the gypsy moth. And in a matter of years, they, you know, around here at least, they practically disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping there's something like that for the ticks because, you know, you go back 20 years, we didn't have any ticks.
No. Nope. Yeah, well, the reason why is we didn't have the development that's going on and pushing our wildlife into smaller and smaller areas.
Uh-huh.
If you look at what it was like over in Cranberry in mm-hmm. 80 versus what it is now, 40 years later, there used to be farmlands and land available for these animals to circulate in. Now we kill deers and things because we're mad at them because they trim our $500 shrub out there that we just paid for.
Eat our hedges. We've concentrated mainly on dogs getting Lyme's disease because dogs... If they're, you know, if your dog is out, even if you're just letting its dog out to take care of its business a couple of times a day, They can come in contact with ticks, mm-hmm. you know, if they're in high grass or Absolutely. Anything like that. What about cats? Do we have to worry about cats getting Lyme disease?
No.
Really?
I've never diagnosed a cat with Lyme disease. But
isn't that amazing?
One of the amazing things about cats is the ticks that are around the eye and the facial area. Mm-hmm. If you take those ticks and send them into a laboratory and have them analyze them, at least 50% of the ticks that are on the cat's eyes and things are positive for Lyme's. But yet the cat does not get Lyme's disease, and that's the model that's actually being studied both for human and dogs. And that's one of the reasons why we have a vaccine out now for dogs was through some of the things that we found out about the cat. Issue is they do not get Lyme disease, but we don't know exactly why, what is the element that they're producing or whatever to get the fact that they don't get it, but yet they have the tick on them that has Lyme disease in it.
Very, very strange. Very, very unusual.
Your cats can bring in ticks and drop them off on your floor. And they're sort of the carriers of Lyme disease.
And they can bite you, the ticks.
And they can bite you, but they don't bother the cats. But, you know, the ticks are on the cat and getting its blood meal, and then they drop off wherever they're at, in your house or outside, and they mature and go on and develop into their next phase.
Hmm. So what then, from a veterinarian standpoint, Dr. Dennis Damon with us here, from a veterinarian standpoint, what's the biggest serious health problem for cats and cat owners? Is it feline leukemia? Because that's a big problem.
Well, yes, but it's only about 10% of the cats to 15% of the cats that end up with feline leukemia. If you go out and you take all the feral cats and test them and mm-hmm. things, they probably there's about a up to about a 20-25% chance in feral colonies that you're going to get leukemia there.
These are the wild cats now that roam the neighborhood,
right? Yeah. And that's because of exposure to animals that have it, and they lick each other, they drink out of the same bowls, they eat together, that type of thing, and that's how that disease is spread. In cats that are born domestic wise, you probably have a less chance, but it's there, and it's a disease to be reckoned with, and actually possibly consider that the cat is negative before you start caring for the cat, because if it has the disease, then somewhere in its lifetime, within 1 to 3 years, it's probably going to come down with either feline leukemia or FIV if they are positive to it.
So what's the biggest problem then for cat lovers and cat owners? Obesity? That can be a problem, can it, for cats?
If I had to say and look at all, both dogs and cats and American people, that I would say that at 65% of all animals that come into my clinic are fat.
Overweight. We feed
and
them too
20%
much.
Of those 65% are obese.
Hmm.
And the animal owner doesn't even know it.
Is this as much of a problem? Because, you know, in humans, we know now that obesity can very easily lead to any number of other
right.
problems, cardiovascular Absolutely. Disease, stroke, and everything else. Same for animals, do you think?
Same for animals.
Wow.
They can have skin problems, to thyroid problems, to adrenal problems, to kidney problems, to heart, all because earlier they got out of hand. And the problem is with obesity is it's there in your pet from about a year and a half on. And it's not easy to get them back off of that weight, just like us. And in animals, it's our kindness that gets them in trouble. because we want to feed them every time they look at us, or give them a treat, or make sure that their food bowl is full all day long. And dogs and cats don't have switches that switch on and off and tell them, I've ate enough, I've had enough, we need to stop.
They just keep eating
because they are food conscious animals, and they will eat to where they will shut themselves off for a little while, but then they'll maybe go back an hour or two later and eat again, and it's just all day long, and we keep filling up the bowl. And
I know lots of cat owners who do that.
Right, they fill up the bowl.
Yeah, and then they let it sit there. So you should put a certain ration in there, that's it?
You should feed your cats just like you feed your dog, or should feed your dogs, and that is you prepare the meal in the morning and you put it down. My animals, I feed them in the morning. I have no trouble about the fact that they're hungry and they eat. Mm-hmm. And they're done. So their bowls are put up until evening. And then when they come in from the outside at their run at 6 o'clock, they know they're going to get fed, that they're hanging around the door, you know. Mm-hmm. If I ask them to hang around that door at 8 o'clock, they're out doing something else. But they know specific times that they're going to get fed. And we only feed them a certain amount, and that's it. We don't feed them till they're full. We feed what is consciously, metabolically, what is required of the day for that time span, and we feed it to them. Now,
twice a day you feed your animals, that's it?
Twice a day. But if I would present, and I did this, I presented my Great Dane with food 5 times a day, and he finished the bowl 5 times a day. Hmm. And he started to put the weight on. But if I fed him twice a day, I could control that weight, and I didn't increase his food any, but he's hungry, and he looks at you, you know, and with sad eyes and looking at you, I even cave in occasionally. But you've got to remember to say, if you're not going to practice it in yourself, which we always grab and get little goodies and things from the cupboard and eat ourselves, which puts ourselves into the fat realm, you should at least consciously make a good effort to try to control weight in your animal, because hidden problems are going to start occurring down the road around 8 to 12 years of age. And that's when you can control things, but you can't stop them.
I saw just yesterday here in the city of Butler, I was up near the Y, up on North Washington Street, the YMCA, and there was a young lady. I could tell she was a serious runner because she had like a workout suit on and her dog behind her on a log leash. She was jogging down the sidewalk, and the dog was jogging to keep up with her on the long leash. Mm-hmm. And I thought, now that's smart. You know, she's getting her workout, and she's making sure that Fido does too.
Right. And very seldom do I ever have owners that get their animals and take them out for a run. They'll let them out for a run, but they won't get them out and take themselves for a walk and walk them and do exercise and things. Most of the time it's the dog doing his own exercise, which he's not going to force him to do any more than what the owner is, because we're all lazy. So a lot of people say, well, he's got a big backyard, he gets lots of exercise. Well, no, if you watch, he's active probably the first 20 to 25 minutes. If you put him out there for 4 hours, I'll bet you 3 hours of it is in the prone position. Mm-hmm. So that's not activity. That's just, he's just doing his bare minimum.
Lying in the shade.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Well, I couldn't have kept up with this young lady. She was going at a pretty good clip, but it gave me a smile to see the dog trotting. It was a pretty good trot along behind her. And a long leash, you know, it wasn't a tight leash, it was a long
leash.
So there was a little bit of leeway there. So exercise is important for us and for your animals.
Right.
I've seen some, not so many dogs, but cats seem to show when they're obese. It really shows.
Yeah, you get a cat that walks across, and if you start to see the skin starting to sag down underneath, especially in the back end, he's definitely toting a lot of fat around. that needs to come off, because they should have that nice little curvature underneath there, like some of the like the greyhounds and things that have that run on the track. They have that nice little curve that goes, and once that curve starts to disappear and become more flat, that means something's causing things to start to fall, and can that's
you,
fat.
Can you save your cat? Can you what? Just cut back on the ration?
Cut back on the ration and give it things to do.
Okay.
You sometimes make, you can get shelves in your house to get the cat to go up on and play with things up there, dangle some toys and things. There's toys that you can buy that emit lights and things that keep your cat active. And you can, I've got up at the clinic pictures and stories of both cat and dog owners that their dogs were sometimes a dachshund that should have been 21 pounds. It's 51 pounds.
Wow.
And you can now imagine what that is in a butterball. And I've seen that dedicated owner get that dog to around 29, 25 pounds, which is still not quite the 21, but it's a he's lost a lot of weight that's going to help him. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at a dog that's 5-6 years of age, sometimes up to 9 years of age, that these people that sort of are dedicated, and they're not allowing their feelings of, oh, I feel sorry for Tippy. We'll give him a little treat, and we give him 10, 15 treats a day, and then that adds up over a period of years. And then the next thing you know, we have a dog that's obese, and we got to do something, and we got to do something quick, which means we're going to have to change our lifestyles a little bit, because it's up to us to do it. We can't get somebody to come in and walk him, although you could, but it's all up to us to do the job, and sometimes people just don't want to face that job.
Cats can be very active too. In fact, young cats, they jump around a lot. They're almost like jelly beans sometimes.
Right. Cats live a serene life, you know, because once they get one cat, and it's very subtle, when all they do is go over the window and look out and see the birds flutter and things, and they go down and lay on the arm of the couch, and they're there for the rest of the day.
And as the sun moves across the room, they move across
they
to
move
stay
with
in the
sun. And that's all they do.
So be careful with how much you feed your pets. Talk about that with your veterinarian. Keep a close, all of us, when we go to the supermarket these days, we're reading the nutritional labels on the food. I never used to do that. I do it all the time now.
Yeah.
Do that with your pet, too.
Absolutely, and you want to look for calories and how many calories you take in. It's very simple. Exercise outweighs the amount of calories that you take in. So if you eat less and exercise more, you're going to lose the weight. Mm-hmm. But if you're equal to or eating more and less exercise, you're not going to lose the weight.
Dr. Damon, it's good to see you again, my friend. It's nice to have you back with us.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed this.
And you're at the clinic now on a fairly regular basis, right?
Yep.
You're not there 12 hours a day anymore like you used to be.
No, I'm slowing down a little bit.
Probably wasn't a good idea to begin with, you know that.
Well, but you can't teach old bulls new tricks.
Good to see you again.
Well, thank you.
Good to see you again. We need to take a break. We'll do that when we come back. We're going to be talking about, we have two topics left on the program today. We're going to be talking, first of all, about being a foster parent. I'll talk with a couple of individuals, a man and a wife who have done this. They've done it a lot, folks. Wait till you hear the story of TJ and Jennifer Min about foster parenting, which I understand is even more important these days, in part because of the opioid crisis. You know, we have many families that are hit by this, where, you know, sometimes even both parents, where, you know, kids have to be taken away by CYS. And anyway, we'll talk about that. And not talk about the negative parts of being a foster parent. Talk about the positive factors with TJ and Jennifer Min. They'll be coming up with us next, and we've got more to talk about after that as well. Part of our program tomorrow will feature details about the Butler Symphony's series of summer lunchtime concerts. They're going to do that again. They've done this for, oh gosh, I will find out tomorrow, many, many years, as long as I can remember. So we'll get the details on that and the lineup of performers for the coming summer. Oh, yeah, it's time for that. Take a break, and back with more here on the Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn on WISR. Back right after these words.
There are two distinct periods in music history, the big band era and doo-wop. Put them together and you've got yourself one swinging night of entertainment. The 16-piece Pittsburgh doo-wop big band with vocal accompaniment will feature tunes from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Doors open at 6, showtime 7:30. Saturday, May 20th on the stage of Butler Intermediate School. Tickets are only $20 and can be picked up at Mays Music Store, Natilly's North, or Tanglewood. Online, PennTheaterButler.com. Proceeds benefit Penn Theater Performance Company.
We are speaking with physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist Dr. Edward Reedy from Tri Rivers Surgical. Dr. Reedy, what types of neurological conditions do you treat?
We would often see patients with simple neurologic conditions such as carpal tunnel syndrome or pinched nerves of the arm, and we'll occasionally see patients with more serious neurologic disorders such as a stroke or brain injury. The treatment for the more serious aspects of these usually involves a fair amount of testing and often hospitalization, whereas the treatment for the more simpler neurologic disorders is usually done on an outpatient basis with medications to fight inflammation and occasionally simple surgical procedures.
To learn more, call Tri Rivers Surgical at their new office near the Clearview Mall in Butler, toll free 866-874-7483. That number again is 866-874-7483. Listeners, going to be talking about foster families, foster children, foster parents on the next segment of the It's Your Turn program here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guests are two. They join us by telephone, TJ and Jen Min. And together they are the author of a book entitled Faith to Foster. First of all, TJ, Jen, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us for a few minutes on the program here today.
Hey, thanks for having us on the show, Dave. We appreciate it.
Yes, TJ, Jen, whoever wants to answer here, what was the purpose of writing this book? Are you trying to raise awareness of the need for foster families?
Absolutely. You know, May is National Foster Care Month, and so we just kind of wanted to push a message that just shows what it's like to be a foster family. You know, it's hard to become exposed to foster care. If you're an average American family, you might not ever know of it or know anybody who's a foster child or taken from their family. And so by writing the book, it's just a safe place to learn about, what is it like to be a foster parent in my community? Because it's really something that happens in every neighborhood across America.
You are a young military couple. You met about a dozen years ago or something like that at West Point. TJ, have I got my dates right on that?
Yes, sir. No, that's about right. We taught Sunday school together here as cadets and ended up getting married shortly after I graduated in 2005.
Mm-hmm. And are you, in fact, yourselves foster parents?
Yes, sir. Yeah, we've welcomed 24 different children into our home over the last 10 years, and that's several moves, you know, between the Army and deployments and things in between. But it's been a great experience, and one of the reasons why we really wrote the book was to encourage Christians and, you know, other just members of the community to get involved and to love their neighbors. I know, I think last week on your show you had the Child Advocacy Center there in Butler County.
We did. Yes, we did. Yes.
You know, there's a lot of people out there that want to help children, and I doubt any of your listeners would ever refuse. You know, we often get calls saying, look, the sibling group just came into state custody. Their parents made some difficult or wrong decisions, and we need a place for them to sleep tonight. And you when you get that call, you're thankful that you're in a position where you've gone through the training, you've been certified to help children, when they need it. And I doubt any of your listeners would ever turn away kids asking, you know, for a place to sleep. But you got to do the training to be able to be in that position to help.
So you knew about one of my topics last week. You must have been checking the website, TJ.
He's a sneaky one, Dave.
So you saw my picture. That's very nice because I have your picture in front of me here, and it's very seldom that I do a phone interview where everybody knows what everybody else looks like. Let me talk a little bit about our guests, folks, and their picture is, by the way, on the back of their book, too, Faith to Foster. TJ, first of all, is a graduate, well, as you heard a couple of minutes ago, we were chatting about West Point, graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He serves as an aviation officer in the U.S. Army, also teaches economics in the Social Services Department, earned a master's degree in public policy from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Jen, meanwhile, graduated from Trinity College of the Bible. She is a certified member of the Association of Certified Bible Counselors, later got her master's in public administration also from the Kennedy School at Harvard. And did I hear you say, TJ, that you live currently at West Point? Is that right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I'm there teaching cadets here in teaching economics.
This is a little parenthetical, but just a year or so ago, I vacationed up along the upper Hudson, and it's the first time I'd ever spent any time there, and what a beautiful, beautiful part of the country that is. Wow.
Yes, sir. And, you know, if you've ever been to West Point, it's a wonderful place. The cadets, the men and women that, you know, America sends here are some of the best, you know, people in the country, and it's an honor to instruct them. And then I tell you, the foster kids that we have in our house right now, they're great role models. They're just surrounded by wonderful people from all over the country, and so it's a good place.
Well, Jen, let me talk to you. You're a graduate of Trinity College of the Bible, and obviously faith figures into your story here. I mean, after all, the title of your book is Faith to Foster, right?
Yeah, you know, we felt like we couldn't tell our story of how we were able to do foster parenting and say some hard goodbyes and deal with some difficult circumstances and behaviors if it wasn't for our faith. So we definitely pulled that in, and my educational background, I think, helped prepare us for some difficult situations we were in, for sure. But I also have a counseling practice on the side, so that's how that all ties in.
You mentioned saying hard goodbyes. Are you referencing to the time when the kids that you're fostering have to leave?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've said 18 goodbyes, and we have 6 kids in our house right now who we will likely say goodbye to in the next year. And I think it's during those times where it takes, you know, pulling on a strength higher than ourselves and just trusting that God's their father and he's watching out for them. And, you know, we just, part of the way we cope with the goodbyes or knowing that they're leaving is just by not thinking about it until the time comes and just, you know, staying in the moment and trusting that it's worth it today. And really, when we see the joys and the life change of the kids day in and day out, we're not thinking about, oh, sometime it's going to end. We're just embracing the fun of seeing them, you know, blossom.
Mm-hmm. There are some practical logistical problems to that many. I mean, after all, you're fostered 24 kids in a fairly short period of time. I mean, there must have been times when it was difficult to get everybody into the car to go somewhere.
Yeah, we're a bustling household. You know, but most foster parents don't have that many kids. It's usually, you know, taking in one or two. But we feel blessed and thankful that we can be in a position that we can say yes to more. But we're maxed out right now. We're maxing out the minivan.
Tell me a little bit about the structure of your book. What are readers going to find when they open the pages of Faith to Foster?
Yes, sir. We wrote this book largely to give people exposure to what foster parenting involves, what it consists of. So a lot of what you'll find in the book is a very open, honest, and candid retelling of several of the cases that we've had in our experience, and then some of the lessons we've learned or some of the takeaways from each of those cases. And we don't we don't talk about every case that we've had, and it's a, I think it's a very just open, honest look, and hopefully we'll give readers the confidence and just the familiarity with foster care that they may decide that this is something that they can do and that they want to do, because we're really suffering right now as a nation from a shortage of foster homes. I read this morning an article, I think, out in Kansas, which I know is quite a ways away, but this is typical of many states where they've had multiple children that have had to stay in state offices overnight, or they've had to farm out, you know, or other states are they're sending kids out to other states simply because they do not have homes available. And so we're trying really to get people to feel comfortable with becoming foster parents.
Jen, have you had foster kids of a variety of different ages?
We have. We've had from birth through high school graduation and literally every age in between, which each age, you know, brings a certain sweet spot. Of course, there's the, you know, the babies that'll cuddle and be with you. But then it's also neat to, with the older kids to, you know, feel more like we're able to be that mentor role and really shape the way that their worldview is as they enter into adulthood.
Have most of the kids that you fostered ended up going back to birth families after there had been rehabilitation there?
Yes, the vast majority, and that's always the goal when a child first comes into foster care. And so there's a certain sweetness of knowing, you know, we get to see the family when they're at their most broken, but then we're also the first to see them when they're, you know, glued back together, and that's a sweet thing to be a part of.
Do you ever get feedback?
Whether it's the birth parent or a grandparent or aunt or someone.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever get feedback from the birth families, Jen?
Yeah. Sometimes it's, you know, especially in the beginning, we try to help and chat on the phone to help that transition. Mm-hmm. And on, you know, on Facebook and social media is helpful for us to stay involved. Because we're a military family, we've moved away from the city where we did a lot of our fostering. And so I think if we were local, we'd be able to see the kids a lot more. And there's some that we haven't had any contact with since the day they left.
Talk a little bit, our time begins to run short here. Talk a little bit about, from your perspective now, or let's say from the general perspective of foster parents, talk about the joys and blessings of undertaking becoming a foster parent.
Of course. So I think the story that comes to mind first is a little girl named Jasmine, 4 years old, came in just super traumatized, literally still had marks on her body from the abuse she had experienced. And she was afraid of everything. She was afraid of washing her hair, of any sort of pet or animal that'd be around, even of playing, you know, in a McDonald's playhouse. And it took months of just exposing her to things and calming her fears to where then she was just a typical girl, chattering away, dancing in her dresses, you know, going to the beach without fear. And just seeing that change was like night and day. And to know that we were a part of it, just it brought so much sweet joy to just the simplest moments of having a meal together and hearing her tell a story.
And I think for me, one of the greatest blessings that we've seen is just the ability of the church and even the community, our neighbors, to rally around us and really to act together in unity. And I think there are very few causes where people can rally together. It seems like even more today with the political divide just being so great. But there are very few causes where people can come together and just everybody is working for the best interest of the child. And it's wonderful to be a part of that and to experience people coming over and helping us, because oftentimes we haven't had the necessary toys or things because we've had to be ready for any age of child, and mm-hmm. and that's been a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, people who are thinking about this, considering becoming a foster parent, will they be able to get some practical knowledge from your book? I mean, in terms of, you know, the steps that you have to take, some of the hoops that you have to jump through?
Yes, yeah. Sir. Absolutely, I think they would be. And you can go to our website of faithtofoster.com, and there's a guide there. And I think anybody that's reading the book will also see several different links and things where they can get more information.
Mm-hmm. Is the book available at your website, TJ?
It is, and also on, and I said TJ, here I am. And also just that you can go into any bookstore, and if they don't have it in stock, they can order it, or on online retailers as well. So we try to make it easy to get into your hands.
Final question, has being a foster parent many times over increased your faith?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, hands down.
The title of the book, folks, is Faith to Foster by TJ and Jen Men, and it's been a pleasure to have them as our guests here for the past few minutes on It's Your Turn. Nice to talk to you, folks. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us, Dave.
Thank you so much, sir.
Sure. So long now. More to come on the It's Your Turn program. Our final guest today, Jonathan Ferreira, coming up, talking about guns in the hands of artists. And he says it's not anti-gun. It's an anti-gun movement effort. Anti-gun violence effort, not anti-gun. Anti-gun violence. That's coming up next on the program. One of our sponsors today on It's Your Turn, Butler Motor Tours, a local company that's been around here for, well, they're in their 77th year now. 77 years. South Monroe Street in Butler, Butler Motor Tours. They have lots of vacation ideas for this summer and even into the fall. If you like to go on vacation and do sightseeing, and a lot of folks do that, I do. Yeah, they have a bunch of sightseeing packages coming up in mid-July. Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island, a couple of the maritime provinces of eastern Canada. Nova Scotia, that's Sidney Crosby's home province, yeah. That's in mid and late July. In early August, Riverboat Bliss aboard the Twilight Boat sailing on the upper Mississippi from LeClaire, Iowa to Dubuque. Well, that would be nice. That's a five-day trip on a riverboat. Skyline Drive in Shenandoah National Park. Have you ever been there? That's a nice trip. And it's a shorter one. August 4th, 5th, and 6th. 3 days. You'll stay at Charlottesville, Virginia, visit Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home, and then step back in time with lunch at Mishi Tavern. And there are lots more sightseeing package trips, too, and there are show trips. There are vacation trips where you can ride a train in New England and Michigan and West Virginia. Check out their offerings online at butlerbus.com. This is Butler Motor Tours online at butlerbus.com. All the trips are there, the dates, the cost, the itinerary, everything. Butlerbus.com. Butlerbus.com. Going to be talking, listeners, by the way, if you're joining us a little bit late on this segment of the It's Your Turn program here on WISR, my name is Dave Mullarkey. Our guest for this segment joins us by telephone. He is Jonathan Ferreira. And we're going to be talking about his just-published book, Guns in the Hands of Artists. Jonathan, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us here today.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks for having the program.
It's an intriguing title. Tell us about this book. What's it all about?
Sure. Well, in the mid-1990s, when I live in New Orleans, Louisiana, in the mid-1990s, when the murder rate in New Orleans was approaching 400, artist Brian Burrell and I mounted the first Guns in the Hands of Artists exhibition, and it was really aimed at taking the conversation about the issue of guns and gun violence in America out of the highly politicized and polarized context and bring it into the realm of art. Art as the language for dialogue, art as a lens through which to look at this issue that faces every community in our nation. So that's really where it started. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, I revisited the project again and worked with artists from across the country, men, women, black, white, and basically challenged them to take guns that were decommissioned by the police department, taken off the streets in a gun buyback, and to use them as raw materials to address the issue of guns and gun violence in their artwork. And that's what the project has been about. And that's what the book is about. And the exhibition itself has been traveling around the country. It started here in New Orleans in 2014. It went to the Aspen Institute for the Aspen Ideas Festival. It went to Washington University in St. Louis, where they obviously have issues with gun violence in St. Louis, Art Basel, Miami Beach, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And just recently, it was at the rotunda of the U.S. Senate building, sponsored by Senator Tim Kaine. And this all took place during the election as well. And so it's really drawing a conversation, continuing to foster a conversation about this critical issue that faces our country, but through the lens of art, using the evocative powers that art has to continue this conversation.
And you yourself are an artist. You are a gallery owner, the Jonathan Ferrara Gallery. You're a curator. Was the exhibit first mounted at your gallery, Jonathan?
It was mounted at my first gallery in 1996, when my gallery was literally in what you'd call the hood, if you will. It was in front of a housing project. And that was the first time that the exhibition was mounted. And then subsequently, it was mounted elsewhere. And then at my gallery in New Orleans, as well as where it started in 2014, and then traveled around the country. So my role is multifaceted in this project. I'm an artist, I'm a gallery owner, and a curator. And as it stands now, I'm also the author of this book. And the book is actually interesting because it serves a purpose in and of itself, that it's not possible for the exhibition to travel to every urban and rural community across America. There's 45 works of art. It's very it's expensive to travel that whole exhibition. But the book, which is an extension of the project, the exhibition, enables readers, viewers to share in this project, to look at the works of art, to look at and read the essays that are have been contributed by national thought leaders on this issue, people like Walter Isaacson, Richard Ford, the Pulitzer Prize winner, Joe Nocera from the New York Times, Harry Shearer, the actor, Michael Waldman from the Brennan Center of Justice, Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. So there's about 17 national thought leaders that have added text to the book in conjunction with images of the artworks to create a moderate, sensible conversation about this issue that faces our nation.
So this is a photographic book then? It's a big book?
It's a big book. It's 224 pages, and I like to say it's a beautiful book. It's a tough book, but it's a very necessary book. The images of the artwork are layered in, and it flows with the essays, and there are also statements by the artists about why they did their pieces and what the pieces mean to them. And all of the artworks in the book are using images of artworks that are made from guns taken off the streets. So it's very interesting when you're reading this book, or if you're standing in the gallery that's filled with artwork made from guns, it's somewhat disarming because you have to have the conversation about what's happening in our country.
Does being concerned about gun violence automatically mean that you're anti-gun, Jonathan?
No, it doesn't. I think that, you know, I live in a city that has a history of violence, and we unfortunately know from whence we speak. But, you know, this is not about taking guns away from people. There are 300 million guns on the streets of America. We're not going to take all those guns away. And that's not the point. The point is for art to create a forum for the exchange of ideas, to foster the conversation, because as we all know, right now the conversation seems to be somewhat of a back and forth polarized conversation, if even that. And what this is designed to do is to have two people that may disagree about this subject look at a piece of artwork and come to some potential common ground, some common understanding, because I think we all believe that we want to make America a safer place and to reduce gun violence in America. So this is not anti-gun. This is pro-discussion. This is pro-conversation, because without conversation, there is no way to really drive us forward and to hopefully make America a safer place.
I've talked with a number of literary critics who argue the same thing about a good book. A great novel or a great play, that it should be something to make you think, that it should be a conversation starter, and sometimes a little bit conflicting.
Exactly. And I think that in his introduction to the book, Walter Isaacson writes that art has always had the power to change society and show us the way to a better place. and to a couple of specific things from history about how art can challenge people's perception, challenge societal norms, and hopefully bring us to that better place. Think about Upton Sinclair, who wrote The Jungle in, I think, 1904, about the meatpacking industry in Chicago. 20 years later, that led to the founding of the FDA. So that's, you know, a very important piece of history. There's Picasso's Guernica about the Spanish Civil War. There's the protest songs of the 1960s. I mean, what do we remember from the 1960s? Remember a lot. We also remember Bob Dylan's The Answer Is Blowing in the Wind. I mean, those art has the ability to open up certain channels in our brain, if you will, and make us think a little bit differently about our society and what's facing us. And what these artists and writers in this book are doing is exactly that. They're holding a mirror up to society and saying, what's happening with guns and gun violence in America?
You are an artist yourself. Did you create a piece for the exhibit, and is it featured in the book?
It is, actually. It's on the back cover of the book, and it's a piece called Excalibur No More. And what I did was, using the Arthurian legend, the sword and the stone of King Arthur, I took a Mossberg double-gauge shotgun, a Mossberg 500-gauge shotgun, and I inserted it into a Colorado river rock. So it looks as if it's the sword and the stone, and we all know the legend that King Arthur pulls the sword from the stone and goes and conquers the world. Well, in my individual piece in this, you can't pull the gun, the Mossberg shotgun, from the stone. It's stuck in that stone. And it's kind of saying, aren't we done yet? And the answer is, obviously we're not, because people are killed every day. Wars rage every day. But that's my artistic statement about asking us to say, when are we done? Where are we going? And it was a very interesting process in creating that work of art. I purchased that shotgun. I bought it online, and the gentleman showed up in my gallery, and I exchanged the money with him. His 15-year-old son was with him, and he had a bag, and in the bag he pulled out the gun. I said, was that it? He's like, yeah, all sales in Louisiana, all private sales are personal. All personal sales are private. And so I was kind of stunned for a minute. We talked about the Second Amendment, and then the son reached in the bag and gave me a bandolier of shells. And then they left, and I was in my gallery, locked and loaded, and ready to go. And there was no receipt, no questions, no one looking at what had transpired. And that's the law in Louisiana, and the law in different states is different. But it was very interesting to me how powerful the gun is, because I went and shot the gun afterwards, because that was part of what I needed to do. But it was an adrenaline rush, but it was also the responsibility that comes with owning a gun. And I think that those things are inherent in the conversation as well.
Is the book available where we find books these days, or must you get it online, or where do we find it, Jonathan?
You can get it in independent bookstores, Barnes & Noble, and on Amazon.com as well.
Guns in the Hands of Artists, by artist, gallery owner, and curator, Jonathan Ferrara. Thanks, Jonathan. Nice to talk with you today. Appreciate the time.
Thank you so much. As a Penn State grad, I'm always glad to talk to PA. Thank you so much.
Okay. So long now.
All right. Bye-bye.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 85-85. The pick 3 is 660-660. The pick 4 is 6532. The pick 5 is 38597. The wild ball for each of those is 0. Your treasure hunt, 14, 21, 23, 29, and 30. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000. Lottery numbers brought to you by New Haven Court at Clearview.
Moving from my home of 50 years was a little scary, but I wasn't safe at home anymore, and my daughter with her busy life, children and grandchildren, it wasn't fair for me to expect so much from her.
We looked together to find a new home and discovered New Haven Court at Clearview.
What made the difference were the employees and the residents we met. The residents said it was a great place to live.
New Haven Court at Clearview, a great place to live because it's a great place to work. 888-261-5753 or visit IntegraCare.com.
Don't forget Schnoor's Greenhouse, Butler's longtime trusted greenhouse. Family owned and operated since 1889. That's right, 1889. For 125 years, it's been the place to grow. And right now, oh, they're humming. Beautiful, beautiful flowers and plants, annuals. They got tons of them. They got hanging baskets, vegetables now. Soon be time to put those in. Tremendous selection from which to choose. Just about any flower plant, they've got it. They're off Herman Road. Look for Schnoor Road by the RC Men's Club. Schnoor's Greenhouse, the place to grow. Coming up on tomorrow's program, guests from the Butler Symphony. We'll talk about the free